Sprouse is a prisoner in Texas. If the state has its way, he'll be dead within the hour. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where prison staff is preparing to put Sprouse to death by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will broadcast live coverage of the killing in Texas, the state responsible for more than a third of all U.S. executions. Execution Watch host Ray Hill, legal analyst Jim Skelton, with criminal defense attorneys Susan Ashley, Larry Douglas, Mike Gillespie, and Jack Lee. Huntsville reporter outside the death house Pat Hartwell, Houston Vigil reporter Dave Atwood. The execution watch for Kent Sprouse begins.
Well, good evening. My name is Ray Hill. You are listening to Execution Watch on radio station KPFT Houston. Hello, fellows up on death row. If you tuned in to listen to Living Art by Michael Woodson, you'll find it on HD 3 channel on KPFT, or you can go to kpft.org where all of the channels are streamed live, and Michael and his guests and staff will be on that channel as well. Tonight, they are intent on killing Kent Sprouse. And he is from Missouri. He is a person. The big matter in this case is, issues related to sanity and, mental responsibility. The lawyers have worked hard to put it together, and, we will proceed with that. Let's see. We have Pat Hartwell. Hello, Pat.
Hello, how are you tonight?
Well, I'm gloom as usual. I hate doing these shows, and I keep hoping for a last-minute stay. Any sign of one in Huntsville?
No, there's no last-minute stay. I understand the Supreme Court ruled several days ago, and we didn't expect anything to be ruled today. The witnesses are just now walking down the steps of the little building to cross the road.
It's the former administration building, Pat. That's where the whole prison system used to be ran, but now it's kind of a near the front gate of the walls enclave, and they use it for several purposes, including store the witnesses until the time. And by that, you mean that the procedure is about to begin?
Yes. When the witnesses cross the road, we know there's no turning back.
Pat, you have been involved in these issues for a good many years, and you have a couple of groups and blogs where you discuss these issues with people more directly involved. What of those might be of interest to our listeners?
Well, there is the Death Penalty News that you can go to Facebook and you can friend them and get a lot of good information. There's also, for people who have relatives up at Polensky, there's the Polensky family members. And Sandrine out of France runs a group that I put stuff on. It's called the Death Penalty Legal News, I believe.
And all of the folks that are involved in these various blogs and groups and all of that, we're kind of interconnected. I know I'm on everybody's list, and I get everybody's stuff. And when I put stuff out on Ray Hill Prisons or my web pages, it also goes out that way. Is there more traffic in these various blogs than there used to be?
There is a great deal more now. People are becoming very interested. Just on a personal note, today one of our members out of Willis was sent a poem from a woman who is not particularly anti-death penalty, and she has noticed the irony of all the prosecutors getting into trouble for hiding evidence, and she wrote a poem about it.
Well, it's not just prosecutors. Some of these judges are biting the dust.
And they should. We wish that they could get prosecuted and put in prison themselves. And it seems as though it's the fad now for them to come out 30 years later when someone gets released from death row and apologize and expect the press to follow them around, and they're in good graces now. And this is not the case. They have ruined people's lives.
This case involves a police officer?
Yes, it does. And there's a great deal down the road here, police officers.
Yeah, the separate crowd, are there any folks there in support of Mr. Sprouse?
Yes, there's about 20 of us here, different various groups, religious groups, and activist groups. And, of course, Steph is here taking his professional pictures of everybody.
Okay, well, give our regards to the vigilance.
I will. And I give my regards to the guys on the row, especially Kent's friends that he's leaving behind.
Yeah, and we hope we don't have to do any more shows for the foreseeable future, but there's several people on the list.
There's three more this month. There's one in May and two in June.
Okay, keep us informed of what happens in Huntsville, Pat.
Thank you.
I sure will.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And we'll go straight to Dave, since Dave is here in Houston. Hello, Dave, are you there?
I am here.
Well,
I am here.
Well, tell us what's going on. Where is here?
Well, we're at a new location now. I mean, we've been here before, but this is new for this year. We're at the corner of Main and Benz, right in the museum district. And we're out here with our protest signs and our banner and making our statement as normal.
Well, the bugs are not bothering you this early, and the light is good, and it's not cold or wet.
No, it's decent out here, and we've been out here, you know, when that sun beats down on you about this time of day, and it gets very, very hot like it does in other places in Texas. But today's fine, and like I've said before, we pick these locations because we have literally hundreds and hundreds of cars that go by and a lot of walking traffic also. And so it gives us a great visibility here in Houston. And I sort of suspect that people think, you know, since we move around, we might be different groups. But we just move around to different places.
Okay.
And, a lot of visibility.
Most of this is organized through the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty?
That's right. That's right. This is PCA to people. You know, anybody can come. Anybody's welcome. We have, you know, there are TCADP people in Huntsville, too, and around the state. I think I mentioned this before. I think there are vigils and protests probably in a dozen different places around the state every time there is an execution. So we try to get out there, and we've been doing it for years and years and years and years, and I personally believe that it really makes a difference, because if you're out here and they can see that you're visibly doing this, I think, you know, it can have a positive impact on people.
It certainly makes a difference to those with the stamina and commitment to be there.
Yep, definitely.
How do people
we've
get
some new people here today, too. That's great.
We'll give them our regards. And how do people get in touch with your organization?
Best way is go TCADP.org, TCADP.org. That brings up the state organization, the website for the state organization, and they can tell, you know, it not only has information on vigils, but educational programs and what's going on at the legislature and things like that.
Thank you, Dave. Our regards to the vigilance.
Thank you, Ray. You take care.
Okay.
And congratulations on your roast.
Thank you, sir. Bye-bye.
All right.
Jim?
Yeah.
This is a different case.
It's real different in a sense, though. This is one of the few times we have somebody who's apparently never been arrested, had no conviction rate, nothing to indicate.
Not since the Candyman.
Huh. Unusual. What happened, the problem is, with the reason this is unusual, this 30-year-old man had a long history of schizophrenia plus drug use.
How does a person with a long history of schizophrenia and drug use not have an arrest record?
Lucky.
Just lucky.
I guess, maybe I have no earthly idea, but apparently he's pretty lucky. Nonetheless, what happened, he kind of wigged out one day. Ends up at a little, he lives from a little town called Ferris, Texas, outside of Dallas.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes to this a service station, convenience store combination, with a shotgun sling over his shoulder like a hunter, with a box of shotgun shells inside of his pickup truck. Goes to the station, and the first thing he does are a couple of guys on a payphone somewhere. He said, no, it was some time ago they're using payphones opposed to cell phones. A couple of guys on a payphone, he takes a couple of shots at them in their direction. And that's what kind of spooked everybody. And then apparently his truck wasn't working too well, and some guy came up and was going to help him do the jump the truck off, and he saw that shotgun, and he said, well, that shotgun's not real. Guy looked in the truck and saw the shotgun shells. He decided it was better to get his jumper cables and leave. So he left. And what happened, there was another man there named Pedro Moreno, who was a customer filling up with gas, and Sprouse shot and killed him. There was no indication there was any confrontation. He just
no
shot
conversation.
Nothing. Just, it's not like that old country song, they laughed at me and then I shot them. There's no laughing. They're just shot. So he shoots and kills this young man, this man Pedro Moreno, who's filling up his car with gas. And, of course, because he'd been some shooting earlier, somebody had called 911. And shortly after he shoots Moreno, a police officer comes up, a 28-year-old young man that had been a police officer for Ferris, and his name was Marvin Stenfield. And Stenfield gets out of his car, and as soon as he gets out, Sprouse shoots him twice with a shotgun and kills him. And then a second policeman arrives, and he surrenders apparently pretty passively. He just surrenders to the second policeman, doesn't try to shoot him, doesn't do anything, just surrenders to him. And then later on, when he was taken to the hospital to have him checked out, he told the paramedics, I just wasted two policemen. One of them was an undercover. So the indication is he probably, at least from his viewpoint,
thought Moreno was an undercover kind of cop.
He said, I wasted two cops. One of them was undercover. And since Moreno was a civilian, he shot him also. And what's interesting about this case is a couple of things. They claimed an insanity defense, and I've asked Susan Ashley to go over all the stuff they did on the insanity defense and the problem with race. That's really all they had, because there's no question about guilt or innocence. He's caught at the scene, caught with the murder weapon, admits it. There's no issues at all about guilt or innocence to speak of. And the only thing they had to go on was say he was insane, because they had a long, long history of schizophrenia and had a long history of drug abuse with using methamphetamine.
Susan?
Well, at the trial of guilt or innocence, six experts contributed their opinion on his mental condition in terms of mental illness and insanity. One of the doctors that was hired by the state, Dr. Goodness, she did an extensive evaluation. She also compiled statements from numerous lay witnesses, and that the defense also put on the testimony of lay witnesses who testified that basically they testified to behavior on his behalf that would certainly cause you to think that he had mental illness, such as him talking to dead people, thinking the CIA or FBI wanted to kill him, and so forth. It would be behavior that a lay person could testify to that would certainly, shall we say, lend credibility to serious mental illness on his behalf. Dr. Goodness also evaluated what the state's mental psychologist had done. The state psychologist had evaluated him for sanity and mental illness, and she evaluated and reviewed what the state's expert had done. Ultimately, she concluded that it was really impossible to tell whether he was suffering from schizophrenia, and it was a long-term thing, that he had been suffering from schizophrenia, and that he, whether or not he knew the wrongfulness of his actions.
Had he been previously treated for schizophrenia? Is there any evidence of that?
Yes, it has a history of schizophrenia.
Okay.
Actually, his mother, not too long before the offense, his mother got him admitted into a psychiatric hospital, a mental hospital, but they only kept him for 72 hours. So, he did have a history of mental illness. But Dr. Goodness basically determined that it was hard, it was really impossible to tell if he was suffering from long-term schizophrenia or if it was drug-induced psychosis from long-term methamphetamine use and drug use.
Is there a difference?
I don't think there's much of a difference, because if you parallel this, methamphetamine will not just make you see things. Remember the movie Beautiful Mind? Much the same thing in that movie, if you remember the movie and the book. He would see people.
The book, yeah.
Well, it was actually based on a true event. He would see people, and he also thought the CIA, much like this guy thought, was a CIA, and that was schizophrenia. And so he's no question he was schizophrenic, because he said, had the same symptoms that the gentleman had in Beautiful Mind. He'd see people, hear voices, talk to dead people, and do much the same thing that many schizophrenics do.
So we have a history of this, and there's some behavior here, like the assumption that civilian is a plainclothes cop. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's obviously a misconception on his part. And why is none of that relevant in a capital case?
It is relevant.
Okay.
Because, see, the thing that makes it, this fits in, it's one of the better cases for insanity, if you can say there's a better case, because he admitted he was delusional afterwards, had a history of schizophrenia before, but more importantly, he didn't run away. It may have been because his car wouldn't start. I don't know.
Yeah, well, that.
But he could run away on foot.
Yeah.
And you would think that if you shot at some people and shot someone else, you would know the cops were coming, you'd leave. And that's one of the things they look at when they test insanity, is whether you try to evade the police. He was there, and then he surrendered docilely. He was docile when he surrendered. He shoots one twice, and the other cop comes up and does no attempt to shoot. Maybe he's out of shells. I don't know. But
kind of shotgun he had.
He had a pickup full of them.
He had a bunch of shells to pick up, but that doesn't mean he's got them in the gun. If all of this is relevant, why did it not mitigate his death sentence?
Well, I think Larry's going to discuss what did me. Oh,
okay.
We're going to discuss
that.
You
got somebody in a row.
I think Larry's going to discuss that. Susan, have you finished?
No, there was also a court-appointed psychiatrist that evaluated him. The court-appointed psychologist was Dr. Crowder, and he determined that he was psychotic when he interviewed him, and that at the time the offense was committed, he believed he was psychotic, paranoid, and delusional, and that he did not understand the wrongfulness of his conduct. So that's what Dr. Krause testified to.
So if he did not understand the wrongfulness of the conduct, that speaks to culpability?
Well,
intent?
That's a test for insanity. That's okay. A test for insanity.
Okay.
But the state had three expert witnesses, and the three expert witnesses called by the state, basically, if you could summarize what all three of them were saying, really was that they believed his psychosis was the result of long-term drug abuse, methamphetamine abuse.
And that makes a difference. If you self-induce your psychotic condition,
I mean, either way, I guess you may be mentally, shall we say, seriously impaired. But that's what
I think Mike's going to cover that, because there's a thing called settled insanity that some jurisdictions use.
Mm-hmm.
That say if your psychosis is caused by your voluntarily taking methamphetamine, you can still claim the insanity defense. Problem is, Texas doesn't recognize that as a defense.
Not part of Texas law, but it may
and
be
Mike's
part
going to go over that, I think.
Also, the three expert psychologists or psychiatrists called by the state, each one of them basically testified that when they visited him, that he was not psychotic, and they, in other words, they had the opposite opinion of what the defense experts testified to.
Okay, Larry, you want a piece of this pie?
Yeah, right. In order for a person to be held responsible for any crime in Texas, there's got to be a showing that that person is both competent and sane. There were two things that were done here. If you raise the issue of competency, which means that if a person has to have an appreciation for the charges against that person and the ability to assist his attorney in his defense, that requires a separate hearing. And one was had in this case, where it was determined that he was actually competent. okay, to raise the insanity defense, what has to be done? There are notice requirements. You have to let the other side know that we're going to raise the issue of sanity. And that raises the possibility of a third kind of result, either guilty, not guilty, or not guilty by reason of insanity. Not guilty by reason of insanity doesn't mean you walk out. If you're found not guilty by reason of insanity, the court maintains jurisdiction over the matter for the entire length of the range of punishment.
Kind of like the Andrea Yates case.
Like Andrea Yates, and so it's not like you walk out. You're going to be sent to a psychiatric hospital and viewed periodically. And even on the competency issue, if he'd been found to be incompetent, you don't walk out either. If you're found to be incompetent, they send you to the mental hospital and see if you would regain your competency. So he was found to be competent. The issue of sanity was raised. Once the issue of sanity is raised, then the defense has to make him available for the state's experts to examine to find out whether the person is indeed sane or insane. And then the defense also has its own experts. And the defense has to raise the issue, prove the issue of insanity by a preponderance of the evidence. Well, the state's experts examine you, and then the state's experts can come forward and testify. And the state's experts not only said he was not, that he was sane, okay, and the issue of sanity is really whether he knew that his actions were wrong. That's pretty much it. And so the state's expert says, well, he knew his actions were wrong. And then the state also introduced testimony from the nurses and from the jail officials who said, you know, he didn't act nervous. He didn't, you know, he wasn't acting erratically, wasn't agitated, wasn't pacing back and forth, wasn't talking to unknown voices, wasn't talking to himself. So they have the opportunity to come forward. And the testimony that they provided was apparently successful in convincing the trier of fact, the jury.
Which that, was the jury in this case.
Exactly. That the insanity, first of all, on the first hearing, on the competency issue, the finding was that he was competent. And on the sanity issue.
The case was tried where the crime happened in the,
yes,
that jurisdiction.
There was no change of venue.
It was Dallas County?
It's Dallas County.
Okay. Dallas is a big place, and the town where it happens is a small place.
Right, and Paris was a town. It was tried in Ellis County. It was outside of Dallas.
Okay.
And even one of the state's experts had the distinction of having written a book about conducting insanity evaluations. So when you call the guy who wrote the book, it's oftentimes that...
Pretty persuasive with the jury.
It's more persuasive with the jury. And so he was found both to be competent... And
well, in your opinion, having looked over the record and scanned the material, did his initial trial lawyers, did they do a pretty good job of trying him?
I can't really pass judgment on what they did. They went through the procedures, the appropriate procedures. Now, the defense experts, as I recall, didn't give a good enough, a strong, he's insane, but rather that's a decision for the trier of fact. There were some issues as to whether the testimony that was elicited from, on behalf of him, did not focus enough on the fact that the schizophrenia, with the perhaps the drug use was really a double-edged sword, with which the defense edge of the sword just seemed not to be used, in that a lot of times people who suffer from schizophrenia use illicit drugs in order to balance themselves off. And it seems as though that issue was not really pushed hard enough, because it just looked like a drug user.
Do you think that a normal criminal trial lawyer is aware of the fact that people with these mental problems have actually read The Magnificent Mind and know how to treat their maladies with chemicals?
Here's the way I'd fault these lawyers. Number one, let's kind of boil it down pretty simple. The defense viewpoint was that he was schizophrenic. He didn't know what he's doing is right and wrong. And they gave all the symptoms, hallucinations, seeing people. The state said, yeah, he had hallucinations because he had hallucinations taking drugs. The drugs called the hallucinations. They said he was crazy because he was using drugs. So they blamed it off on the drugs. And self-induced drugs that makes you crazy is not a defense in Texas. Now, here's the two problems with claiming the insanity defense. When you have a psychiatrist, you have to let a psychiatrist, say psychiatrist, examine your client.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is he can come back at punishment and said, I've examined this man, I've given him all these tests, there's no question, he's a sociopath, he's dangerous, and he'll kill people in the future.
Because the jury is sitting there thinking they got a target on him.
Because, see, the problem is once that psychiatrist testifies, examines this man, he can come back at a punishment hearing and say he's a sociopath. So what you're doing when you claim insanity, you're also opening the door for expert testimony at punishment saying he's a danger to society. The second problem you have with insanity defense, you scare the hell out of a jury. Because if they think someone's crazy, would walk into a place that did people he didn't know, even delusional or not, and shoot people, they want him out of society. So what you've got to do as a lawyer, I mean, you have to do, this is the second part of the insanity defense that they didn't do in this case, my only fault. You should have presented expert testimony from people who treat schizophrenics and say, look, we've got a program set up. I have treated 10,000 schizophrenics over a period of 5 years. We know how to control them. We got this program set up.
So
you can't just throw it out there.
If you don't have that.
Well, you can get that.
Okay.
Because, yeah, a lot of people have schizophrenia that operate fine in everyday society. Walter Boyd, for example. And we have a lot of people that, well, sort of operates okay in society. But, you know, we have a lot of people who are schizophrenic who can adjust to it. In fact, the guy who had that was schizophrenic in the book, The Beautiful Mind, was a brilliant mathematician, and he's operating fine without medication. But what you've got to do, because when you're proving insanity, you're also proving incentive to give the death penalty, because you're just afraid that he'll do it again. So you've got to provide a program, give the jury an alternative to.
You've got to provide some hint of a fix.
You can fix it or control it. You won't fix it. And another thing that should be argued in these cases, whether it did or not, being a schizophrenic is not a question of choice. You don't choose that lifestyle. It's something that, you know, happened to you because your chemistry isn't working right. And it's much like executing people because they're born with red hair. That's the biggest argument you can make. It simply isn't fair. But what you've got to do is go a step further and knock out that fact they could be dangerous to society by presenting a program showing this is possible to control this person. You're not going to cure him, but you can control him.
Mike Gillespie, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Susan.
You could have put that on at punishment.
Well,
you would have had to put it on.
You got to put it on regardless. You can put it on, but it was never done. They didn't call any witnesses at punishment in this case.
The defense didn't call any witnesses at all at punishment.
No.
They put on what they had at guilt or innocence.
They shot their whole deal.
And the state put on
But it's the same jury. So they,
right.
The jury
it's the
was
same
exposed
jury.
To.
And the state put on one witness at punishment. It wasn't terribly significant. It was a deputy that testified that he went to the house on a disturbance call and that the guy he had a weapon, nobody was arrested. So it wasn't anything like really, you know, significant.
In fact, it would help because it shows he's not going to kill everybody who works in the uniform.
And that was put on by the state. So.
Right.
He said thank you, but it didn't work. Mike Gillespie, you've been wrestling with these things.
Yeah, what I'm here to talk about is the appellate steps of there were writs filed in this case
based
upon inefficiency of counsel. And what happened in this case is that the two trial attorneys who tried the case handled the appeal. That's not a proper way to do that. In those days, that's what the courts did sometimes. They appointed a trial attorney. The reason that's not a good procedure is because if you're going to go to court and make a claim that the trial attorneys did a bad job on inefficient assistance of counsel, you need a second counsel neutral to make that allegations. If the attorney doing the direct appeal, how can he make a claim saying that he was incompetent and did not do a good job? So there was a statute passed, 2604, that changed that. And with that statute, what it says that unless the defense, the defendant, and the attorneys agree in open court to allow them to stay on the case. They don't stay on the case, plus the court's got to find good cause not to appoint independent counsel. That was not done in this case. What happened was during the time period of the motion for new trial, the trial attorneys found out about that law, and then they filed a motion to get themselves off the case because they were not appointed properly. So they were removed. Now the court appointed a true appellate attorney to handle the case. Well, the first thing he filed is a motion to extend the time for motion for a new trial.
Yeah, because the clock's ticking.
The clock's ticking, and he had no time to do it. So the first issue brought up was, did he have the right to get an extension of the motion for a new trial? And what the court's held is no, he does not get the right to get the extension. And the reason for that is that there were lawyers appointed to the case during the time period clicking, and they could have filed the appeal. The fact that they didn't file the appeal does not mean there's reversible error. The second thing what they said is that, to be fair, the errors that go up on inefficiency of counsel are not the direct appeal errors. They're writ errors that are brought up afterwards. So there was no harm. The transcript was not returned yet. The new lawyers could not look at the transcript to see what the lawyers did. But what the appellate court ruled is it made no difference what they did or not. It's more proper to bring this up afterwards instead of in a direct appeal through a writ. So they basically ruled there was no error, and they let that go.
Well, is there a flaw in the system because of all these clocks?
I think the clocks work themselves out. The problem becomes a true problem is, how does an attorney on an appeal attack how he handled the case? That's the problem.
Let me tell you what the safety measures really are, Ray. And we need to kind of clarify some things. Number one, you've got 30 days after the trial's over to file a motion for a new trial.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot get that extended. It's a deadline automatic. What happens, you can request an out-of-time motion for a new trial.
That's on a direct appeal.
Because you can't extend that 30 days. That's 30 days, it's over with.
Okay, but that motion is just going to say a new trial based on these things.
And what you've got to do, anytime you file an ineffective point, no court is going to consider an ineffective point unless, number one, you have evidence in the record of why the lawyer did or did not do what you're accusing him of doing. And you've got to develop that issue during the motion for a new trial. You've only got 30 days to do so. And so what the courts have advised, and another real danger if you try to develop that issue within 30 days, the big problem is you can't develop it adequately because a trial record is not available within 30 days generally. And here's the real danger of bringing it up on direct appeal, is that if you bring it up on direct appeal and don't do an adequate job, you may be barred from using that in a writ, from bringing it up in a writ. So what they did to cure that problem, they permitted wide latitude after the direct appeal is over with, to develop the ineffective point on a post-conviction writ. In fact, there have been many, many opinions telling every lawyer the wise choice to do, unless it's just obviously really something terribly erroneous, that anybody would say it's erroneous, like overlooking a self-defense claim or doing something horrible. Don't ever bring up ineffective points on direct appeal, wait and do it at writ, because then you have the trial record, you can bring the lawyer forward to testify, and you can, at that point, you can have a benefit of all the record and present to you. They give you a big evidentiary hearing, so you can cure that problem simply by waiting to do it at the writ stage. And that's what they're doing.
That's what they're doing.
Right.
So after that, they did file the writ in federal court to try to prove inefficiency of counsel. And they made lots of allegations against the lawyer that they did not do a proper job. The problem with it is that, as Jim mentioned, we've got this rule in Texas called settled condition. And what that basically means, as we've talked about earlier today, is that your voluntary drug abuse is not a mental condition. That's not a reason to be innocent of a crime or to be found mentally incompetent of a crime because of drug abuse. For that reason, the appellate court said the lawyers were on the wrong track, that Texas law is settled on this concept of settled insanity, that because it was not an issue to be brought up, it was not something to say.
Maybe I'm missing something here, but whose responsibility is to decide whether it's the drugs that cause the mental illness or the mental illness that causes the drugs.
But that's what the court said. It says the Texas statutes are clear. It makes no difference.
It makes no difference.
Makes no difference.
I mean, if you're crazy and you take drugs to dose your insanity, is the same thing as you're normal and take drugs and become insane. It makes no difference?
Well, what happened is, like I say, they took the way you settled that by a psychiatrist. The defense psychiatrist said he does know right from wrong because he's schizophrenic. And the state psychiatrist said he does know right from wrong because he takes drugs. And that's called settled insanity, which is not recognized as a
Sound very settled to me.
Well, I'm just saying that's what I didn't say the law was smart. I said the law calls it that.
Okay.
That's why. And some jurisdictions have settled insanity as a defense. But Texas says if you voluntarily take drugs, that is never defense to anything.
Okay.
And so, and who decides?
Similar to DWI.
Right.
Intoxicated manslaughter. If you voluntarily
drank the alcohol
and
got in your car and
get intoxicated. Right. Even if you're so intoxicated that you don't know you're in your car driving, the mere fact that you voluntarily got intoxicated, you're held criminally responsible for everything that flowed from it.
I have an interruption from Huntsville. Pat?
Yes.
Have you got a report?
The witnesses are coming out, so we know that Mr. Kent Sprouse is dead. He has been executed by the state of Texas. Number 523 for the state of Texas and number 5 for Greg Abbott.
And they had enough chemicals to do it this time. And from what I understand, the chemicals are wrong.
They have enough chemicals to
finish
do anything they want to.
Yeah. Well, I didn't the professional association say no mas?
No, the professional association gave them an edict to please don't do it.
Okay, it was a it was not a no mas, it was a please don't.
Yes, and we've always got to remember that in last May of 2014 is the month that Greg Abbott accepted a $350,000 campaign contribution from J. Richard Richie Ray, who owns Richie's Specialty Pharmacy out of Conroe, Texas. And that was the month that Greg Abbott
changed his position. Well, why am I not surprised that Pat Hartwell remembers that?
Well, I do remember it, and everyone should, and I encourage anyone that uses a compound in pharmacy to ask the owner if they supply execution drugs, and if they do, don't give them your business.
Just keep reminding us until November of a couple of years from now.
I sure will, and I want to say hi to the guys, and once again, I want to express my condolences.
Well, while you're on the phone, I've got one announcement to make. Our friend from death row, Carrie Max Cook, is currently in St. Luke's Hospital having open heart surgery.
Oh.
And he and I have been in communication. He's scared. He's lonely. And so I want you guys on the row, because you live down there with him. You saw him grow old in that environment from the young man that Tyler sent there on a wrongful conviction to someone exonerated and part of the movie and the play Exonerated. Let's think positively for Carrie Max, okay?
We sure will.
Thank you, Pat.
And we will be back next week for Manuel Garza.
Well, maybe there'll be a stay.
We're hoping.
You know, he's almost, they tell me that he's ready to go. Once in a while, they stop him if they're ready to go.
We hope there is a stay. We hope for every stay, and we hope right up until 6 o'clock when we see those witnesses come out of that building.
Well said, Pat. Good night.
Good night.
Well, Jack Lee, what's your piece of the puzzle?
Well, I want to talk about the problem of running an insanity defense in Texas.
This one didn't work at all.
Oh, there were a lot of
problems. Was it destined not to work?
To a certain extent, generally an insanity defense is very difficult to do. to the point of being next to impossible? Because ultimately, and Jim touched on this, the problem that you're running into is if you can prove that somebody's insane, if you can show insanity, well, what's the solution after you find them not guilty by reason of insanity? Well, unless you have a plan for them after the insanity, after you're innocent from because of insanity, well, I mean, the jury isn't going to want you to be out in the you're a continuing threat to society. And part of this is that, you know, let me set the table here. There are two issues, and I think a lot of people confuse the two, incompetence and insanity. The incompetence is if you're my attorney and you ask me, Jack, do you know what's going on? Do you know that you have to go to trial? And I tell you, potato. That's incompetence. I don't have any way to help you in putting together, you as the attorney, help you put together a defense, and I don't understand what's happening in front of me. That's incompetence. So if I'm incompetent, they send me to a nut house, they drug me up until I can vaguely say yes or no to the questions, and then they can try me. There's insanity. With insanity, you fall under the McNaughton rule. And in the McNaughton rule, you are insane if you can't distinguish between right and wrong. Apply the McNaughton rule to this case. If Sprouse thought that he was under attack or that he was in immediate bodily harm by other people, he has a right to self-defense. If he has a right to self-defense and he really truly did believe that Moreno was an undercover cop who was about to kill him, and the police officer who showed up was also in the process of killing him, he has a right of self-defense. And with the McNaughton rule, you're looking at the subsequent behavior to figure out whether to try to indirectly figure out what that current state of mind was. Here, Sprouse sat there. He didn't run. He didn't go anywhere. When the second police officer showed up, he surrendered peacefully. He surrendered docilely. And then afterwards, he makes the statements that he killed two cops. That would probably, you know, this arguably fits under the McNaughton rule. Except what happens to you once you're found insane? What's the plan? What do you do afterwards to make sure that you're not, that the person who's found insane is not a continuing threat to society? And if you don't have a plan, what's the jury going to do? The jury's going to say, look, you may be insane, you may be nuts, but I don't want you out on the street. I don't want you out there. What's the plan afterwards? And unless you lay the foundation for that, it's really hard to convince a jury, you know, he's insane, but we should let him go.
All right. Do you think that, I mean, you're a trial lawyer. I mean,
sure.
Pick juries and put them in the booth and do the best you can. Do you think it would be even possible to succinctly describe this case to a jury in a way for them to put it into kind of this philosophical context?
I think it's very difficult to put any case into a philosophical context. When you can, when you pull it into a philosophical context, you generally have juries who are going to be more lenient because, you know, it's...
And how do you arrange that?
Ooh, very, very difficult. First of all, they have to be open to it. If they're not open to it, you can beat them over the head as much as you want, and they're still not.
So you look at the panel, and there are a bunch of socially concerned, civil libertarian college professors. You got a chance.
Yeah.
If there are a bunch of welders and longshoremen and street pothole repairers, you ain't got much of a chance.
I don't know. Some of the most philosophical people I've known have been carpenters.
Well, I mean,
really,
that gets into religion and stuff.
Oh, I'm sorry. I don't mean that in a religion. I mean, really, I have philosophical discussions with people who are carpenters.
There's a new documentary about me, which is going to call me a fisher of men. So, you know, I go there a lot. Right?
Gotcha. So should we start addressing
about
you?
Welders, Ray, because all of them are convicted and can't serve on juries anyway.
Welders is a done deal. All right, on you, welder. There's several welders on death row. Hey, fellas. The more we do this, and we've done this now, what, Jim, 5-6 years?
Yeah, long time.
We've done this 5-6 years. The more I look at this thing, I'm trying to put myself in the mindset of somebody who is a registered voter in the jurisdiction and therefore qualified to be on a jury, and how these theories can come together in such a way that I can get my mind around them.
Ray, being educated doesn't mean you're open-minded.
Oh, you're absolutely, that's absolutely
being
right. I remember Dr. White at Stephen F. Austin Nacogdoches. Had to go to the panel to get a grade.
Blue-collar guy doesn't mean that you are incapable, much less not closed, to different ideas.
No, blue-collar guys are my kind of people. My parents are labor organizers. I know that. I mean, if I'm going to have a jury, give me a bunch of labor goons. I'll take it from there.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, to a certain extent, your socially minded college professors may not necessarily be the kind of juror that you want, because they're going to be in an ivory tower. They're going to be closed-minded. They're not going to understand what it's like to work with your hands.
Yeah.
And what it's like to try to plan out, what am I going to do this week so that I can make it so that I can make rent and things like that.
Well, this guy had mental health issues probably most of his life.
Yeah.
Is that safe?
Yep. Sure.
Do people like that have a chance?
Well, let me tell you what you should. The way to approach it, you got to remember that really the death penalty is really a revenge. It's an emotional reaction to a crime that they don't approve of. And people.
And they make it that. We go out of the way. So prosecutors go out of the way to find those emotions.
First thing you want to do when you pick a jury in a case like this is do your best to figure out, as a general rule, women are more emotional than men. So in a case like this, I would probably want men on the jury because women are, for want of a better word, fairly narcissistic, and they always think everything's going to happen to them. And so I would probably want men because they're not as emotional. And the second thing, everybody in Texas, especially around the world, has a sense of fairness. And I think the way you pitch that is real simple, that schizophrenia is not something he chose to be. And is it fair to execute somebody
because they were born that way? But we've said that in other cases. Mm-hmm. We have said that regardless of whether juries are males or females, we have said that mental illness is a chemical thing.
Right.
Your body's making chemistry that you get high on. And I know some schizophrenics.
Well, what I was going to say before you stepped in, then you want people on the jury who had family members or people who've had history of having people that they knew that were mentally ill. Because what you want to do is find some juror who can relate to this man. If somebody you find out during your jury examination that somebody on the jury had somebody who was hospitalized because of a mental illness, they know how to cope with this. They understand what you're talking about. So what you're doing when you're picking a jury, number one, you want to get rid of anybody that's really emotional. Number two, what you're looking for is somebody who's had some experience, family-wise or otherwise, in dealing with somebody with mental problems, because then they can associate with the unfairness of killing somebody simply because they were born with a condition they had no choice over. So you're asking how to pick a jury. The truth of the matter is, what a lot of scholars have done, they think this should be taken away from a jury. The death penalty on insanity defense should be handled by a group of psychiatrists, not jurors. But if you're going to have a jury,
well, you brought that up before, too.
Right, right.
If we're talking about a mental illness issue, we need somebody with that kind of expertise.
But see, that's what you want on a jury. You want someone who's not terribly emotional, like an engineer type.
Yeah.
Can you look at things?
Well, there are women psychiatrists.
I understand that. Yeah. They need them, but go ahead. It's kind of like that.
I'm trying to tidy up after Jim. Meanwhile, I'm getting shot at by the producer.
Okay. Tidy away, Ray.
No, I just, you know.
Don't you remember the story about the poor gentleman whose wife was trying to poison him? He was a Catholic, couldn't get a divorce, so he went to talk to his priest, said, "I've got a terrible dilemma. I don't want to commit a cardinal sin and divorce, but my wife is trying to poison me. Would you talk to her?" The priest went and talked to her and said, came back and called the man, said, "I spent 3 hours with her. Take the poison."
It's a better deal.
A better deal.
Okay. Okay. Now, we're laughing at the demise of Kent Sprouse. And Kent never had a chance.
Well, look at the case in Boston, Ray. The Boston Marathon bomber. Okay. If you listen to any of it on TV, what the commentators are basically saying, okay, this is a federal death penalty case.
Yes.
This case, what they're all saying is that the government has a very high burden. A lot of these people that are commentators are saying that, you know, they think if there's any, they're sort of leaning with that he probably won't get the death penalty. That's where a lot of them are going. And what the reasons they're saying that is, they're saying the case is being tried
in Massachusetts,
in one of the most liberal states in the country. The case is being tried in a state that does not have a state death penalty. Mm-hmm. They're also saying that, strangely enough, counter to what Jim was saying about women.
All right, Susan.
They're saying
you're a woman.
That,
you have to admit
okay,
that.
Okay, so. But. This is just an example. It could go either way.
The plumbing is just
a young boy who's nice looking, and women fall in love with.
Well, they're also saying because I guess there's a fair number more women on the jury than men, that the women would be more emotionally sympathetic with the defendant on trial, and less likely want to, shall we say, have him executed. That's what they're saying. Also, he's got a dream team. He's got an excellent group of lawyers. One lawyer, a female lawyer, defended Susan Smith, mm-hmm. and they didn't execute her. So apparently he's got an excellent team of lawyers. Also, he's, you know, his age and the basic.
Well, I mean, if they give him a life sentence in federal penitentiary, the chances are he's either going to be a very, very old man or he's not going to survive to get out.
It would be life without parole.
Yeah, it would be life without parole. Do they have that?
Yes.
If they have life without parole in the federal system, they give him life without parole. It's a death sentence. It just takes it longer to get here.
And they basically played almost everything on guilt or innocence because the basic thrust of it was that he was under, shall we say, such over-influence from his older brother, you know, being he was the younger brother, the older brother, that's kind of like the tack they went, that he was, shall we say, his free will was sort of overcome by being over-influenced by his older brother, being a young student.
Yeah, I understand that thesis.
A foreigner, you know.
I understand that thesis, and that's going to take some working by the jury. But wrap up because I'm going to do a little editorializing.
Okay. Now, the other side is, of course, there was a lot of damage of what happened. So that's
emotional and physical.
Yeah.
There were three dead bodies, as I understand?
Well, and there were
a lot of innocent people and children injured, too. I got to confess, I don't like doing this radio show. I love radio. I love talking to you, the radio audience. It's a wonderful position to come into a studio where I don't have to put up with you, but I can talk to you and enter your mindset and bring you ideas. And I'm richly rewarded with having thoughtful people on the staff of this program. Elizabeth is very tolerant of me, and that's not easy to do. I understand that. And the lawyers put in a great deal of work and effort to make this whole thing almost make sense. It never quite does, not because the lawyers are failing, but because the idea never quite reaches the point where it makes sense. We had one program director around here one time suggested that what the program needed was a death penalty advocate to be on the show to give it balance, and I thought that would probably cripple what we're trying to do here. We do the show basically Joe Friday. It's just the facts, ma'am. The lawyers put together their understanding of the case, just the facts, what happened, how did it happen, all that. And their opinion is colored by the fact that they are lawyers. They have been trained to be lawyers. They do this sort of thing every day. And as they sit down and they look at these cases, they wonder, what the hell would I do if I were stuck with this dog of a case? I think that they're outpouring. Jim gets pretty philosophical sometimes about the theories of the law, and that's good, too. That's an important element. The rest of the lawyers just kind of sort it out and deal with it as they would deal in their own practices. I just do radio. That's all I do. I come in here and do radio. For that to work, I need producer Elizabeth Stein to do her magic. I need Otis McClay to do his technological work to get it on the internet. I need Mark Pirtle to do the videos whenever we interview inmates. We've got a wonderful board operator tonight. Give them your own voice.
How's it going, everybody?
Okay, there you go.
This is Jacob. Thank you for the opportunity of letting me
Jacob
in here
is,
for you.
Jacob is a new staffer around here and does a good job of that. You can hear him weekdays at 4 o'clock. My name is Ray Hill. Kent Sprouse is dead. I want to thank Jim Skelton, Susan Ashley, Larry Douglas, Michael Gillespie, and Jack Lee, the lawyer team. Pat Hartwell, thank you for being who you are in Huntsville. Dave Atwood, thank you for being who you are in Houston. This is Ray Hill for Execution Watch. Tell your friends they can get it on the archive, and good night. Jesus' name!